The answer to my question, even Francis doesn't know. So it's a rhetorical question. The highest announced events that have been observed are at 2 PeV. So I'm going to address the issue of what happened to the events above that. So here's a bit of a introductory message here. There's several pieces of information carried by neutrinos, the direction from which they come, the energy of which they carry, and their flavor structure. And so the issue of are there events above 2 PeV, of course, is an energy issue, but it will also become a flavor issue in what I have to say, because if there is a cutoff, fundamental or otherwise, it could be fortunate, and then we'll learn some physics, maybe astrophysics, maybe fundamental physics, but it could also be unfortunate in that we don't get to use the rather amazing flavor resonometry properties of a glacial resonance at 6.3 PeV, and we wouldn't get to see the rather amazing double bang properties of new taus, as I'll explain a bit. So ice cube data, we have missing events above 2 PeV. I'm going to talk about how many continuum events we think we should have seen. Of course, that depends on two parameters, the spectral index, and it depends on how many events we think we should see at 1 to 2 PeV. So three events are measured at 1 to 2 PeV. I'm going to take 1 to 2 PeV as a fiducial energy. Could be 1 to 2.5. Could be 1 to 2 point square root of 0.6, for example. But I'm going to take 1 to 2 PeV as a fiducial region. Three events are seen. Does that mean we expect three events? No. It means that three events are observed. The expected number is not known. Then I'm going to talk about the resonant events, the glacial resonance at 6.3 PeV, what we would learn, what we might learn from that, if events are seen at that energy. I'm going to talk about how many events should be seen at that energy compared to the continuum events. I'm going to do an overview of statistics, because a lot of this talk will involve statistical physics. And then I'm going to return to the 6.3 PeV non-events, the so-called glacial resonant events, and suggest that maybe no glacial is a good glacial. This is no reflection on personalities. This is a reflection on the absence of events. Maybe not seeing events will tell us something really fundamental. I'm going to take that point of view. Occam's razor would say that if we don't see events, it's probably because there's a natural cutoff in sources, or there's a steeper power law, or there's a broken power law. And Wyler's razor says that Occam's razor is really boring, so I'm going to try to say maybe we're viewing something more fundamental. There will be consequences, not for me, but for physics, and then I'd like to end with some ideas. So I don't need to show the data. We've heard some talks on that. Suffice it to say, and at this point, I'm going to eschew this laser and use a hockey stick. I've been looking at this for 4 days. It seems like a fantastic thing to use in a talk. So here is the gap. We've learned that it has no statistical significance. It's not what I wanted to address anyway, so I don't care about that. It's been filled in somewhat by new mu data, so it seems to be going away. Claudio told us there's only a 43% probability. There is a 43% probability that it's a random fluctuation. What I want to talk about is not this. So this is the new mu data. Nature seems to have looked at her statistics and realized that a gap in the track and shower data should be overfilled in by an excess in the new mu data. So that's under control now. What's not under control, here are the two events at a PeV and one event at 2 PeV, and then a lack of events, just upper bounds on these from the ice cube data. So I want to talk about what's going on or not going on beyond 2 PeV and energy, the lack of events up here. So the expected number of events in that region, which are missing since we see none, depend on two parameters. One is the spectral index, as I mentioned, alpha, the power law, the energy spectrum. And the other is the number of events we expect in that interval. We see three. I'll just remind you of that. The number that we expect in any interval is given by integrating the differential spectrum. So when you integrate a spectrum that falls like e to the minus alpha, you pick up a 1 because you've done an integration, and you pick up a 0.40 because that's the energy dependence of the cross-section. We took this number from the famous paper of several years ago. Halsey, do you want to remind me what the authors are? Raj, do you want to remind me? Ina, yeah, and Quig. Three people here in Quig. So you expect an energy to fall like this. If I take the maximum energy to infinity, get rid of it, think of this as an unbroken power law. And then I just normalize it to the same integral from 1 to 2 PeV multiplied by the expected number there. And this is the number then I would expect at an energy above E1. So everything we expect at higher energy regions are going to depend on what we expect in the 1 to 2 PeV region. So here's some examples. If I take falling power laws 2.0, 2.3, the extreme one 2.5, plug it in here, I get the number above 2 PeV given by what we expect in 1 to 2 PeV times these numbers that are of order unity, but they differ by more than a factor of 2. Then this involves some calculation. We've done the calculation. I'll tell you who we are in a minute. The number of Glashow resonant events at 6.3 PeV, it also depends on the number that we expect at 1 to 2, hidden in the number above 2 PeV here. But I've written this as a ratio which is pretty constant over the spectral indices. It's about 3.4 times R, and R is the fraction of earthly flux that's in nu e bar. What does that mean? The Glashow resonance process is given here at the top. It's a special resonance since matter has electrons and not positrons and not muons and not taus. We have nu e bar can hit an electron and turn into a W. The W is the resonance. Today we call it the W, I guess way back when it was called the Glashow resonance. And if you write S in two ways, the Mandelstam invariant, one is fixed target, you're hitting an electrode at rest, and the other is center mass, and just solve for the resonant energy, you get 6.3 PeV. So here we are. We've got events below 2 PeV. We've got none above 2 PeV. We've got a falling spectrum. It's not illustrated here. The rising spectrum here is the 0.4 from this paper of Gandhi, Quig, Reno, and Sarchevich. And here's the resonance. Boom. It jumps up a factor of 240 above the continuum here. 240 above the continuum. So it's huge. However, when you integrate over it, the width comes in, and the fact that it's only in the nu e bar flux comes in, and you end up with a modest factor, but a measurable factor, and that's what's given in this slide. You end up with 3.4 times the fraction of nu e bar to all neutrinos times the number of events you expect above 2 PeV. Now I'm going to show you a table of various ratios, but this ratio, as Walter pointed out, it depends on what's happening in sources on the other side of the universe. Now, Walter gave realistic examples and showed that R can be mixed and complicated. I'm going to simplify things, kind of an Occam's razor of my own. I'm going to simplify things and talk about some idealized sources, idealized reactions, and what they will give for this script R value. I'll tell you, the punchline is it ranges from 5/9, that's 0.56, to zero, with probably the favorite model giving something like 0.2. So if I take 3.4 and I multiply it by 0.2, I get something like 0.7. So you can see that it's of order unity. I expect the same number of resonant events at 6.3 PeV as I expect above 2 PeV. Here are the examples of 56%, that's 5/9 that they get from a beta beam. What's that? That's, imagine a neutron decaying, which makes pure nu e bar. But then it gets processed en route to Earth. And the processing tells us that at Earth we have 5 nu e bars to 2 nu mu bars to 2 nu tau bars. So I end up with 5/9 as the final ratio of nu e bar to all flux. 5/9 is 56%. The other clean, pure, somewhat unrealistic example here is if I have a P-gamma reaction going through just the delta resonance, not the multi-pion, just the delta resonance, it would make a delta plus, which decays to a pi plus, which decays to a mu plus. And if you follow the chain, you end up with no anti-neutrino at all. I'm sorry, this is damped. I want to say this again. Pi gamma makes delta plus, makes mu plus. The mu plus gets whisked away, loses energy in the magnetic field. And so one only then has the new mu in the source, which then gets processed at Earth. But I started with no antineutrinos, and the processing then leaves me with no antineutrinos, so I would expect no glass shell resonant in that case. So we don't know what R is. The nice thing is if neutrinos do span a measurable spectrum up to 6.3 PeV, we can try to measure R, try to infer R, and learn something about the dynamics of sources on the other side of the universe. I think that's fantastic, by the way, the 3 pounds of mush in our head saying something about what's going on the other side of the universe. Okay, maybe I have 3.5 pounds. Here's some, maybe I have less. I had surgery in 1997. All right, so here's some formulas for the glass shell resonance. I put them up here just to show you that we did think about it and we did calculate this carefully in the Wii. What happened here? I'll come to that. So there's a peak, and there's a flux. It depends on the value of the flux at 6.3 PeV, so it's going to depend on the spectral index. We think we roughly know what the flux is in 1 to 2 PeV, but the index then would determine what it is at 6.3. And the peak resonant is a typical weak cross section, 10 to the minus 31 centimeters squared. Now, the resolving powers of this glass shell resonance was written down, I think for the first time in this paper by Enchardoke, Goldberghausen, and myself, where we wanted to use this process to determine whether the sources were PP versus P gamma. PP would make pi minus as well as pi plus. At the delta resonance, P gamma would make just pi plus. And then without the magnetic field, it would be an undamped process. But one would end up with factors of what I called script R, the ratio again of nu e bar to all neutrinos. They were quite different in the two cases. So we proposed the glass shell events rate as a discriminator between PP and P gamma. And some nice work on this glass shell resonance has been done recently, jumping to now, by Bhattacharya, Gandhi, Rodiohan, and Watanabe. And I have one of Walter's papers. He has several, but an example, a very nice one, is this particular paper with Bearwald and Bustamante. So here are the models of the astrophysical sources that I'm going to consider in an idealized setting. PP makes pi plus or minus pairs. This is the famous Compton process that most people would have on the tip of their tongue as a first guess. You start off at the source with a ratio of 1 to 2 to 0. You process it, you get 1 to 1 to 1. Actually, in a careful paper led by Sundip, you get 1 to, in a careful paper led by Sundip, instead of 1 to 2 to 0 at the source, you get 1 to 1.86 rounds to 2, and then at Earth it rounds to 1 to 1 to 1. So here I would have 1 nu e bar per 6 flavors, the 3 flavors plus nu plus antineutrino. So I get a ratio for R of 16.17. Here I would damp out the muon. I would start off with pure nu mu and nu mu bar. And it arrives at the Earth 4 to 7 to 7. It's a ratio of 11%. P gamma, pi plus only. This is going through the delta plus resonance. That's an assumption, probably a poor one. I end up with 4 to, I end up in the neutrino channel with 14 to 11 to 11. And if it, and let's see, actually I'm a bit confused why I have two there. Anyway, it's 7%, it's even less. If I damp the mu plus, I get no antineutrinos. Charm decay gives me something quite similar to the 0.17, I get 0.19. And then the culprit, as we see, the one that was too good to be true, and nature agrees it's too good to be true, if I had neutron decay, I would get to 5/9, to 56%. So these are the numbers for R. You can see it spans 0 to 56%. Most common guess is about a sixth. Now I'm going to digress into Poisson statistics a bit, because how many events we should see and the statistical significance with small number of events is Poissonian. So let me tell you what I've learned in the last couple of years. I think it's kind of nice. Some of you already know this. Maybe some of you don't. If I write one as an exponential and the inverse of that exponential, and I expand one of them, I can read off from here the probability that if I expect mu events, I get n events. It's just one of the terms in the sum. The sum sums to 1, so as all probabilities should, if I sum over n. So this is the Poisson distribution, the Poisson probability for observing n events when the mean or the expected number is mu. Now, we don't know what the expected number is, but we know what we've seen. We've seen 3 events. So there's an inverse to this problem, which has been taken up some years ago by Feldman Cousins. They asked the question, if you're an experimenter and you see n events, what's the expected number? So they did a lot of work, and they wrote a paper that's somewhat obscure. And Danny Marfatti and I have beaten our way through it in the last couple of weeks. And there are tables in there, and the relevant table for us is it tells us that if you see 3 events, the expected number at different confidence intervals depends on the confidence interval. So I'm going to take 2 sigma probability, or 95% confidence interval. If you see 3 events, the expected number can range anywhere from 0.8 to 8. 0.8 to 8 at 95% confidence. So what does that mean to us? Not much. It's a wide span. We're going to have to deal with that. Getting back to Poisson, nice things about the Poisson distribution is the mean value is what the expected value by definition or by calculation. I think we all knew that. The variance is also mu. And so if I look at signal to noise, I have mean value over variance, and I get a signal to noise that grows with the square root of the expected number. We knew that result, but here's the derivation. Moreover, and this I didn't know, I just never thought about it. If I take the Poisson probability and I integrate over the expected number from 0 to infinity, it sums to 1. It sums to 1. So Feldman Cousins, I'm rediscovering it, yeah, that's it. I'm sure it's all in the PDG. So Feynman and Cousins integrated this, not from 0 to infinity, because that would give 1, but took an interval region and said this equals the confidence limit. The real contribution, I could slide this this range around, and as long as I have finite support, I could vary the range and get a given confidence limit. But the real contribution is giving a prescription for how you choose this range or for what the centroid value should be. And it's complicated, and if you're curious, you should read their paper. But it's partly Bayesian because you put in what you know, that is the number of observed events. And as I said, at 95% confident level, when you see 3 against 0 background, they also consider backgrounds, the expected number is anywhere from 0.8 to 8 at 95% confidence limit. But we have more information than they knew when they wrote their paper. We know there's no events observed above 2 PeV. There's 0 events above 2 PeV. So I'm going to take in what follows 3 expected values as representative, 1, 2, and 3, that is less than or equal to the number that observed. Because if I took more, it would just exacerbate a bad situation. So I'm going to disregard 4 through 8 in the expected value and consider 1, 2, or 3. And there's a misprint here. It should be for the first two we have to view the three events we see at 1 to 2 PeV as an upward fluctuation. If I expect 1 and I see 3, it's an upward fluctuation. If I expect 2 and I see 3, it's an upward fluctuation. If I expect 3 and I see 3, I'm spot on. A couple of special cases of the Poisson distribution. At least John and maybe all of you know these things. But if I see the number I expect, I can use Stirling's formula. I've got a one parameter formula, and this is what the probability is. So if I expected 3 events and I saw 3 events, the probability is 23%. If I saw 3 and I expected 2, the probability is 18%. If I saw 3 and expected 1, the probability is 6%. Now, these are all roughly equal viable, because what I should do is renormalize them, say this one to 1, I divide by 0.23, and you can see that all these can happen. So this is kind of our first lesson, that we don't have enough data. We all knew that. But we don't know what the expected number is. We see 3 events, expected number, my representative samples are 1, 2, and 3. When no events are observed, there's another special case of the Poisson distribution. It's just e to the minus the expected number. So if I expect 1 event above what I've seen and I see 0, 37% probability. If I expect 3 events, 5% probability. These are probably viable. If I see 5 events and I expect none, it's getting pretty small probability. So let's see what happens here. In this column, I've got spectral index 2, 2.3, 2.5. Let's see. The continue events I expect, it's all normalized to the expected number from 1 to 2. My representative samples, this can be 1, 2, or 3, times 1.94. And if I add the resident contribution, the Glashow contribution, that's the plus 3.4 R. R is this ratio I told you about, nu e bar to the total neutrino flux. Okay. If I make the spectrum steeper, I expect less. 1.94 has become the 1.15, and if I make it even steeper, I expect less again. So let's take a representative, an example. Let's take the spectral index of 2.3, which we're told is the favorite index now of IceCube. And let's take the case where the nu e bar flux to all neutrino flux is 1/6. Let's take the democratic, the complete pion chain. So I put those numbers in, and the numbers then that I get, if I expect 1 event, then the number I get above 2 PeV is about 1. If I expect 2 events, the number is about 2.3. They scale with the 1, 2, and 3, because everything scales with the number I expect in 1 to 2 PeV. If I add the residents, then I expect above 2 PeV 1.81, 3.62, and 5.44. And I see none. So the probability of this happening as a statistical fluctuation is e to the minus 5.44. It's quite low. This is e to the minus 3.62. It's not great. This is e to the minus 1.81. So here are the answers one gets. 16% probability that the expected number is 1, and I see 2 above that. Now, also, 3 events are observed in the 1 to 2 PeV range. So remember, if I expect 1 and I see 3, then the expectation of 1.5 continuum events above that is already met by the events I've seen. What is not met is the extra resonant event, because that has to occur all the way up at 6.3 PeV. So there's an energy dependence implied in going from this column to this column. Okay, it's not. It hasn't been included in this calculation. Okay. So conclusion one is, of course, we need more data. We don't know what the expected number is. Could be 1, could be 2, could be 3. Probably it's not more than that. Three is very problematic, 2 less so, and 1 is survives. So let me move on now. No Glashow is a good Glashow. Suppose we resolve the problem by just saying the spectrum cuts off, as Francis showed us today. then there's different ways to do that. And one way is, the radical way is to say that there's a maximum energy available to neutrinos. End of story. It breaks Lorentz invariants. And we put out a paper where we here is the authors that you see listed started with Anshar Doki. The nice thing about A is always first on papers, and the bad thing about A is he's always the one to take the blame first on papers. So this paper has 8 authors. I know that in a painful way. If you pull down the LaTeX file and reference cite this paper, as you all should, of course, then it will give the first 6 names and the last 2 become et al's. I find that rather strange. I've threatened to work only with Catherine Zurich going forward. This paper violates Lernard's theorem, which says, do you know what it says? That every paper should have 1 good figure, because if somebody gives a conference talk, they might want to use it. This paper violates that theorem. I have no picture to show you of this paper. But it makes a testable guess. The guess is that neutrinos are stabilized, that neutrinos don't exist above 2 PeV or a few PeV. And the test is that means if I also stabilize its charge partner, SU2 partner, the electron, it also means that at high enough energies, the charged pions become stable. They can't decay because they would make leptons with more than this energy. It means at very high energy, the neutron becomes stable for the same reason. So these are testable, and they change how we would think about and calculate cosmic ray physics. You may know there are anomalies in cosmic ray physics, even within the Auger data, and certainly when Auger data is compared to high-res. So I don't know if these issues would be ameliorated or exacerbated by this ansatz, but it would be interesting to know that. The stabilization is being worked out in some detail by Denny Marfatia and my student Peter Denton. So let's look at this. So if I take the boost factor of a 2 PeV neutrino and give it a mass of 50 millielectron volts, which the lower bound mass for Nu3, I get 4 10 to the 16 for the gamma factor. Gee, if I took M. Planck and divided it by the weak scale, I get 5 10 to the 16. Is this a numerical coincidence, or is there something to this? Well, you're thinking numerical coincidence. But fortunately, it's testable because it stabilizes the pion and the neutron at high energies. So it might be suggestive to set these two equal to each other and say that there's a gamma max. Blame it on broken Lorentz invariants. There's a maximum gamma factor of M. Planck over M. weak. And notice that suggests a connection between gravity, Planck mass, and the weak interaction. Why there would be one, I don't really know. And so this involves work that I did with John Lernard. We have slightly different views on where this relation could come from, but we do have views on where this relation could come from, which I'll show you. In fact, the way this collaboration got started, John had a view that the weak scale of the neutrinos should somehow involve the weak VeV. And when I took his suggestion and put in some numbers, I discovered the accuracy of setting the gamma factor equal to M. Planck over the VeV. And so he was already excited, and then I got it excited. So we wrote a little paper. So here it is again. So it's an Emax in what frame? Well, nature provides a nice frame, the cosmic rest frame. Emax in that frame can be written as the dot product of the 4 momentum with the cosmic rest frame 4 velocity. And once you write it that way, you've got an invariant here, and Pmax transforms as the usual 4 vector. So if you want to find it in any fast-moving frame, by the way, the Earth and the cosmic rest frame are related by a non-relativistic transformation. So for all practical purposes, we're in the cosmic rest frame. But there are some frames which would not be, where you could have other Emaxes. OK, so since this paper, half the authors on this paper are John Lernard, he remembered his theorem and he made a nice figure, and here it is. So here's a gamma factor rising with energy for the neutrino. When it hits 10 to the 16, that's the highest energy you can have for a neutrino. That's this vertical line. Highest energy neutrinos observed. A little above that is the Glashow resonance. It's kind of unfortunate that if this hypothesis is true, we won't get neutrinos to measure the Glashow resonance. So no, in terms of this hypothesis, no Glashow is good Glashow. In terms of this hypothesis, no double bang is good double bang, because we won't get the energies to see the double bang either. So John has helped one foot by shooting the other one, and Sandip is the double loser here, I think. Then, because the relation involves the weak interaction scale and gravity, we put on here highest energy cosmic rays, just to give you an example, unification scale, the gut scale, and here's the Planck scale. In my waning 1 minute, let me show you something else that I find interesting. If we insert Weinberg's neutrino mass operator, which I've written down here, 1 on lambda Higgs doublet times left-handed lepton doublet, Higgs doublet times left-handed lepton doublet, suggests that the neutrino mass is given by the Vev squared over lambda. So if I substitute that into the previous expression for the neutrino mass here, I get Vev squared upstairs, which cancels against one Vev here, and I get Vev upstairs, and then I get lambda downstairs. So I can solve for lambda, and it turns out to be the gut scale. So I can rewrite the relationship then. If we assume that the Weinberg operator is the origin of neutrino mass, is the same scale I showed you before, could look like this. So Emax over M Planck, 1 over M Planck is root G Newton's constant, is equal to the Vev over M gut. I have no idea where that comes from. If one cosmogenic neutrino event is seen, this is out the window. But Francis told us today two are expected and none are seen. I can tell you the probability of that's e to the minus 2. Of that being a fluctuation. But if tomorrow Claudio or Francis tells us they've seen Berezinski's at Zeppelin neutrino, one of these cosmogenic neutrinos, then this stuff is wrong. So here's a bunch of reasons that John and I have concocted for why this might be right. And you could eyeball through those, or you can make your own model. Bjorkane has a model where he's got an inverse Fermi energy, so anything below 2 PeV is allowed. Anything above 2 PeV is excluded by Fermi exclusion. These three Spaniards wrote a paper where they tuned KK modes and the distance between K modes to make a formula like ours happen. But in fact, outguessing nature, it doesn't matter, because it's really an experimental issue. If there's a cutoff, it could be due to several things, but it could be due to something fundamental. So yes, incredible claims require incredible evidence. There's data still coming in. Maybe it will disprove all of this, or maybe it will support some of this. But here's my summary. The multi-PeV continuum and Glashow resonance rates are in borderline danger. So it's worth watching to see if we get more higher energy events above 2 PeV. The Glashow resonance can reveal the neutrino source dynamics on the other side of the universe. If we get events at 6.3 PeV, we'll certainly have to do what Walter suggested, consider more realistic, more complicated scenarios than the simple ones I've outlined here. But until we get events at 6.3 PeV, I don't see any reason to complicate the issue, especially in talks like this. If events above a few PeV do not arrive, so I and Danny Marfatia, we have our feet in both bases here. Well, several, the Hawaiian group, we have our feet in both bases. Whether neutrinos are seen above 2 PeV or not, at least one of our papers will be wrong but forgotten, but at least one of our papers will be right and possibly remembered. So if events above a few PeV do not arrive, then damn it, either nature cuts off the sources, and we've seen, heard of an example from Walter, we've seen cutoffs proposed, phenomenological cutoffs proposed by Francis and Claudio. Last week we heard a talk here by Halsey and Ina, and they have other authors too, on a non-pion chain. It was choke jets with charm production. According to Chris Fryer, also here, this has problems with some astrophysics, but the jury's still out, I think. We could have a broken power law, that's a possibility. Or we could have fundamental physics. Now, C is testable, is distinguishable from A and B, and then it predicts no neutrinos at a higher energy. End of story. We'll never see Glashow. We'll never see cosmogenics if nature is much more whimsical than Occam and takes option C. Okay, thanks.
Okay, time for some questions. Clarification first, comment first.
So I disagree with Tom that one or the other has to be wrong. I'd say both can be right, because the cutoff could be above the Glashow resonance.
Ah, I see. Okay.
That's the win-win-win.
But below the cosmogenic. Otherwise, there's no test. Okay.
So for the maximal energy, you just put a cutoff here. For the maximal energy, you just put a manual cutoff, as far as I understand, or like a modified dispersion relation of the neutrinos, right? Is there a kind of a systematic way to understand if I have such a modified dispersion relation or a breaking of Lorentz invariance, why that wouldn't affect, you know, ultra-high-energy cosmic rays or other charged particles? I mean, there must be some kind of systematic approach in terms of effective operators or some other.
So at this point, I think it's premature to ask for a model for which there's no data. Protons are made out of quarks, and so you can imagine the cutoff on the quarks, and the mean x at high energies is something like 10 to minus 5. And so I think it'd be okay to have a maximum energy for the neutrino of a PeV and a maximum energy for quarks inside a proton, and therefore for the proton of 10 to the 21 EV. Alternatively, one could just say that these cutoffs had to do with the lepton sector and not the quark sector. It sounds ad hoc, but there's so much we don't know. And if you look at these motivations, or reasons, excuses, whatever you want to call them, there are models where Lorentz invariance is a emergent low-energy symmetry. Let's see, I want to jump down to the one with extra dimensions. It could involve extra-dimensional physics. That's certainly gravitational, because gravity propagates wherever there's geometry. And we know very little about extra dimensions, if they exist at all. What we do know is they're very different from our dimensions. Otherwise, we would see them as big. So I think there's all kinds of possibilities that can be imagined. And we didn't pinpoint a particular one, because it's premature to do that, I think.
But the point is, you can't get anything else to a gamma of 10.
That's true. Well, cosmogenics would have a bigger gamma, but depending on if the cutoff is around 2 PeV, they don't exist. That's right. This is a,
you know,
it's a fantastic
figure,
gamma factor.
The easy excuse, wrong as it may be, but even the electron at the highest energy cosmic rays is not getting up to kind of gamma factor that that neutrino is at PeV. So if indeed that story that we concocted is correct, then it's the only place you'll ever get to investigate Lorentz invariance violation is with the neutrinos.
So John's saying that the proton mass is so much bigger than the neutrino mass, I mean, by a factor of 10 to the 9, that one would need an equivalent gamma factor of 10 to the 26 for the proton, and that's not going to happen. For the electrons, you need a bigger gamma factor by its mass, you know, MeV over EV, a million. But electrons diffuse, and we're never going to see cosmic ray electrons at that energy. So a point we did make in the paper is it's only in the neutrino sector where one could observe such huge gamma factors. If there is a fundamental cutoff, it would only be seen in the neutrino sector. So we took that as a plus for neutrino astrophysics and ice cube. We'll see. Yeah, technically the gamma factor, right. Which is E over M, and then we have to argue about what M means, right?
So this is kind of an obvious comment, right? But
pardon? Yeah, go ahead.
It's an obvious comment, but it's not that either of those have to be right. Right? It's not that unless your spectrum is cut off, then you have to have the gamma. They're perfectly plausible other new physics explanations that don't involve going to gamma.
Well, I listed some broken power law, steeper spectrum, or just...
No, these are astrophysical things. So yeah. If you say unless there is an astrophysical cutoff, then it has to be gamma, but there are other ideas.
Well...
I mean, there are papers online today to this effect, right? This.
Right. Gee, who are the authors of that?
I have no idea.
Sure, there could be absorption.
There could be absorption due to new physics. I'm just saying an obvious comment is that if there is a dearth of neutrinos or if there is some sequence of bumps and troughs, then of course it's a lot of fun to figure out what it is, but there are other options other than
you're right, and I was wrong. There are other options. They all involve fundamental physics.
They involve very interesting new physics, but
new physics. Any one of those would be fantastic.
So, I know that Danny wants to have his cake and eat it too, but it seems like with the neutrino mass from the mass splittings, there's some limit on how far we could push this cutoff. In this model, right? I mean, the cutoff can't be infinitely high, or am I misunderstanding?
Well, actually, when we wrote the paper, we had it as an energy cutoff. I wrote it as gamma just because that's slick notation. So, again, there's no theory for this. And so if you treat it as an energy cutoff or a gamma cutoff, it would make a difference when you have different masses of neutrinos. You might say, what if the first neutrino mass is zero? Then, I mean, if a neutrino is massless, it's like the photon, and its gamma is always infinite. But I think the first neutrino is not massless, and the light is special. Gary Steigman and I talked a bit about this yesterday. Light is special. It has no proper time. It's always here and now for a photon. It's a boson, these are fermions, there's all kinds of excuses that can be made.
While we're talking about the possibility of Lorentz invariance violation, Kosolecki has made what I grudgingly came to think of as a nice point. If you write down a Lorentz violating interaction, it can lead in the same way that small delta M squareds lead in neutrino oscillation to visibly large phases. Lorentz invariance violating interactions can also lead via the amplification in oscillation to visibly large effects. The phase, instead of going like L over E, would be proportional to E or something like this. It would.
So my understanding there is that at least these two people looked at his theory or his model, but also that his model has so many parameters you can get whatever you want out of it. Is that?
Oh, I wouldn't call it a model, just an observation.
Okay. Well, so Vernon and Danny ruled out some of Kosolecki's more minimal models, something called the bicycle, etc. But I think it only involved maybe two or three or four parameters, and he's got. Oh, okay. Yeah, I see. So I guess the spirit of your comment, Boris, is if this were to be true, and one would bet somebody else's money, but not our own, right? But if this were to be true, then a lot of things would change. I mean, this is upsetting fundamental physics.
Further questions, comments? Okay, let's thank all the speakers for the afternoon session.